It is 8:30, and we have with us this morning, live in the studios, Jeff Stevens, Peggy Hotz, and Vanessa Pepoy, all with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I should point out, if for people going, where's Jav and Maria, that you three have, Jav and Maria are out today. They can't make it in, and you three graciously and courageously have volunteered to come in and fill their boots for the next 29 minutes.
We're going to try. Actually, we know where they are.
You do?
We do. Jav and Maria like to go down and do the Puyallup every year, so they're down doing the fair.
Okay, so people head down there right now.
Yeah. No, not really.
I know Maria likes the
she likes
animals.
The livestock.
She
livestock.
Does.
She grew up on a farm, and Jav is really good at those midway games and brings back a lot of stuffed animals.
Yeah, I understand he actually used to run some of those midway games some back where he grew up.
And the elephant ears. Everyone loves the elephant ears.
All right. So let's dive into what's been going on over the last week, starting out with local and the Bellevue teachers' strike.
Back in the late spring, the Bellevue Education Association members voted overwhelmingly that if they didn't have a contract by fall, they would strike. And that district has about 1,200 teachers and 16,000 students. There are three major issues of contention. Of course, pay is one. The last offer from the Education Association was asking for a 5% raise for teachers. The district is offering 3%. That was as of Thursday, and they did meet yesterday, so I don't know what happened yesterday. The second item is insurance. The district wants the teachers to cover a greater share of the cost of insurance, and that ranges according to what the teachers' needs are. The third one, and I think the most interesting one, is that the district would like the teachers, is forcing the teachers to use a web-based curriculum. A few years ago, the district got a grant from the Gates Foundation to use, by the way, Microsoft program that helps them put curriculum up on a web. Now, the problem is that the teachers must use the same lesson every day. So, I mean, each day it's specified what lesson you'll use. And you can't change that without submitting and writing your reasons for wanting to do so and what you plan to do. Now, that really flies in the face of everything we know about good teaching and education. For example, it would mean, well, it does mean at the eighth grade level in Bellevue, you can't talk about the presidential elections for another 2 months because you're not on that day. So if you were teaching geology in a high school science class and, God forbid, Mount Rainier blows its top, can't talk about it. Plus, you know, there's always the thing of what we'd call the teachable moment, yes, is one, but also there are no accommodations for the students who need more challenging material or the students who, you know, need a little help. And, you know, if a teacher assigns, say, you to read Hamlet, different classrooms are going to have different discussions about that same topic, and the professional teacher knows, you know, how to pace that class and lead that class, and you can't really script something like that. I also discovered that Bellevue uses $1 million a year in private technology that they purchase for this program that handles the demographics of the students, you know, where they live, what their parents' names are, their attendance, and so on. Well, other districts use a free program. Now, it still costs something to manage that program. The districts who use the free software pay about $77 a year for each student. Bellevue, using this private software, is paying twice that much. So with a district that size, that right there is about $1 million. And you have to wonder about why so much focus on private technology in that district. So that strike, it's up on the website of the school district that the kids won't be coming to school on Monday. So that's the Bellevue strike.
All right. Moving on, the Goodwill site reached an agreement this last week?
Yeah, the Goodwill site is down on Dearborn. It's a 10-acre site with a Goodwill store and training center on it. It's called Little Saigon. A developer is planning a Target, a Lowe's, six or eight other mid-size sort of stores, and 40 to 50 smaller shops, and that's been in the works for a while. Community organizations formed a coalition, and they worked out something they're calling a community benefit agreement with the developer so that the community gets something in return for accepting this large development. Unfortunately, it seems top-heavy in favor of labor. Now, it is, of course, good that contractors will have to pay prevailing wages, use apprenticeship programs, focus on hiring contractors that are women-owned or minority businesses and so on. But the developer isn't really giving up so much in this instance. There will be affordable housing on the site, but, for example, the developer isn't making any direct monetary contribution to that housing. It'll be built by Seattle Housing Authority. And then the developer has to give $2 million to the community under this agreement, but a large part of that is in the form of a rent reduction spread out over 10 years. And $600,000 of that money is going to a Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce, and there's no agreement about how that will be used. Now, they got a verbal promise from Mayor Nichols, I think that's an oxymoron, that some of the money that they'll get from things like vacating alleys and streets and so on, he has said that that will be channeled back into the community, but that's not written down in the agreement. Now, the coalition is saying this is groundbreaking stuff, making this agreement, but those of us who've been around a while have heard of the Seattle Displacement Coalition led by John Fox and all the work that they've done, and I doubt that they would have made the agreement, which this coalition has made, that in return for these things, they will not oppose and be supportive of the rest of the things that anything else the developer wants to do. So getting permits and variances and so on, a part of this agreement, they won't say anything. And frankly, I doubt sincerely that the Displacement Coalition would have stopped struggling this soon and would have let some of those things go. But that's what is happening in the Goodwill area.
All right. I want to jump over to you, Jeff. The University of Washington signed a contract with Nike here.
Yes. Actually, what's going on with that is that the UW's actually signed a contract with Nike originally in 2001, and now they're currently planning to making plans to renegotiate and renew the contract for another 10 years. And a group of student sweatshop activists named Student Labor Action Project are currently trying to organize a community response to those plans, and including especially the meeting of the University of Washington's Board of Regents this month, which will be on September 18th. The Student Labor Action Project is hoping to organize the community response at that meeting to convince the university to reconsider the negotiations. One thing that they are trying to convince the university to do is to add stipulations in the contract to ensure workers' rights, because the current contract stands, there are no guarantees for worker rights.
And didn't this all come out during the break between the quarters? That's kind of interesting.
Yes, the UW has a history of doing that sort of thing. Any decisions that they've made in the past that might meet with opposition from community activists, they tend to time these things cleverly. Such as right now, they waited until to start the negotiations for this contract. Until they announced it the last week of summer quarter, when all the student activists who otherwise normally would have been ready to organize opposition to this most of them have gone away for the summer break, and they're planning to renew the contract right here in September, between summer quarter and fall quarter.
Now, what's Nike's general reputation with its overseas facilities? I remember, I just saw it again recently, that Michael Moore, the filmmaker Michael Moore, had made an offer to, is it Philip Knight?
Yeah, Philip Knight.
Yeah, to pay his way to go check out his Nike factories, because Philip, at that point when he made that offer, I think it was just a few years back, Philip Knight had never actually been to one of his factories overseas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I believe that clip is from it's in a couple documentaries. I believe that's in Michael Moore's The Big One and The Corporation, the documentary
that's
that came out
saw.
A few years
okay.
ago. And I believe that was actually from that clip was from right about 1999 or so, during the first wave of student anti-sweatshop activism. Nike is a particular point of contention with anti-sweatshop activists, both in the student movement and the broader nationwide movement, because they're really the company that laid the groundwork for a resurgence of the use of sweatshop labor in the 1980s. And it's really daring of the UW administration to not only have signed that contract with Nike in the first place, but now to be talking about renewing it. Because in the school year preceding the signing of the original contract in 2001, the 1999-2000 school year, there was a lot of pretty high-profile anti-sweatshop activism on the UW campus, including both the undergrad and graduate student governments passed resolutions in favor of a sweat-free campus, and Washington Students Against Sweatshops, the group active on campus at the time, were trying to petition the university to sign on with a worker rights consortium, which is a newly created national organization aimed at getting universities to, as the saying goes, make their campuses sweat-free by taking steps to ensure that all their licensed university apparel is made in fair labor conditions. So in 2001, when Nike negotiated this when the UW originally negotiated this contract with the UW, they knew full well that there was a strong community concern about the sweatshop issue pertaining to the university. And now, during the past year preceding this latest decision to renew the contract, was a second wave of strong anti-sweatshop activism led by Student Labor Action Project that culminated in May 2007, over a year ago, with the UW agreeing to sign on to something called the Designated Suppliers Program, which is an initiative of United Students Against Sweatshops, a national student anti-sweatshop organization. Which was a new means of ensuring that public universities nationwide are taking steps to ensure that their apparel is made in fair labor conditions. So again, we have history repeating itself here. Two instances where the University of Washington, knowing that there was strong community concern over the sweatshop issue, has pretty much gone against that community concern and opinion and begun negotiations with the Nike Corporation.
It's interesting, too, that I know Charles Kernighan, who's the director of the National Labor Committee, who's like one of the lead, or once upon a time was one of the lead organizations dealing with the sweatshop issues, has repeatedly stated that it's the students and the student movements that have really been at the forefront mm-hmm. of changing policies here in the U.S. on mm-hmm. this issue. So that's one we need to keep an eye on. Let's move on. And the Times apparently had a article this week talking about the Seattle claims about shelter space being good in the city of Seattle.
Yes, it's laughable, isn't it? The city has added 35 more shelter beds. If you saw the little picture in the Times, those mats on the floor are so close together. I mean, I would rather stay in a tent. But anyway, they now have added a whopping 60 beds when the one-night count of the homeless in King County this year was up 15%. To about 2,600 people every night in King County without a place to stay. 23 homeless people have died outside or through violence in King County this year. The last two that the King County Medical Examiner notified us of were really sad. They all are sad, but one of these was a woman, Lynn Smith, 57 years old, who committed suicide in Kent. and Sandy Mockler, who, 47 years old, was found dead in his car outside Sacred Heart Church on Lower Queen Anne. And the church people knew him and realized something was wrong when they saw his shoes still on top of his car in the middle of the day. So what the city really needs to do is just stop with the sweeps. And if they're not going to provide enough shelter that and respect people's dignity, then they really need to support things like Nicholsville. Now, Nicholsville is a project. Actually, it's a project of Veterans for Peace Chapter 92 of the greater Seattle area, because, you know, everyone, I think, knows that there are so many homeless veterans. And Nicholsville is being organized by homeless people. It'll be a stationary community somewhere in the city of Seattle. And it will be set up before the end of summer, which is the equinox, actually, technically. So within the next couple of weeks, Nicholsville will be set up. It'll be a shantytown like a Hooverville. It'll be self-managed. There will be rules, and everybody will be expected to help with the work. So they're still meeting on a weekly basis. They had their rally last Friday. They had a die-in at Westlake Park. They're at the point now where they really would appreciate donations of building materials, you know, even used things, things you might have around your home that could help somebody build a place to keep dry at night would be helpful. They have a website, NicholsvilleSeattle.org. So because Veterans for Peace is a 501c3 organization, monetary and material donations are tax deductible. So we hope that people will support Nicholsville.
Yeah, I understand 25% of the homeless are made up of veterans.
Yes, yes, they are. And so, you know, I went to some Nicholsville meetings this summer, and there were many veterans there who aren't being supported by the government, and so are on the streets.
All right. Moving on to national and the Republican National Convention this week. Not a place to be if you're a alternative media producer.
Yeah, it's interesting. The RNC was obviously the big story this week, and we've obviously heard a lot about Sarah Palin, some of it thoughtful, some of it not quite so. But what we haven't heard enough about as far as what's going on at the RNC has been the behavior of the police in St. Paul. And the preemptive arrests of protesters who had come to St. Paul to protest the convention, and most importantly, the arrests and the intimidation of independent media at the RNC. Basically, what happened with the police even before the convention began, they had been doing surveillance on activists who planned to come to the convention, and found out where they were staying. This sort of thing, which has been done before. At a lot of political events in recent years, and basically did a lot of massive preemptive arrests of protesters. Among the people, noteworthy independent media people who were arrested at the RNC was Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, which got some press, but again, not enough.
Yeah, as well as a couple of her
colleagues.
Colleagues,
yeah.
Thank you. And even people from, I know, Pepper Spray Media, which is a local video coalition, they had at least one or two of their people arrested. It was quite amazing, the numbers and the number of individual incidents, both of, I believe, one was where they folks were watching a film at one of the buildings, and basically police came in and just grabbed everybody for a period of time.
No actual illegal activity going on, but the police came in and arrested people anyway.
Well, I think in some cases they'll claim that there's a hostage, so that gives them the right to burst into, you know, a room.
Yeah, and also they also tried to stop or did effectively stop the Rage Against the Machine concert on the grounds that, or they claimed that Rage Against the Machine would incite a riot, quote unquote. So.
And Amy Goodman's arrest is, like, there's multiple pieces of that and related to that on YouTube. So people can check that out. They can probably just Google that.
Well, you know, the other protesters that they're holding, I think one important thing to recognize is that they're keeping them a long time. You know, they're not letting them out. so that they can prevent them from doing anything to upset the convention. So they don't let them go when they really should.
Yeah, isn't it by law they can only detain people for up to 36 hours, but they're evidently holding the protesters
without charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it's up to 36 now. I thought it used to be 24. Dating myself. do we know as of this morning if everyone has been released?
Not as of this morning.
So, all right.
That's story still unfolding.
Okay. All right. And probably any recommendations for where people can turn to for more information on that besides the state, perhaps the indie media sites?
Yeah, and Democracy Now, the Democracy Now website. I'm sure Amy Goodman will be
covering that
mm-hmm. firsthand.
All right. Well, moving on to international, and we've been hearing about all the storms and hurricanes that have been building off in the Atlantic and how they affect us here in the U.S., but apparently they're affecting other countries as well.
Imagine that. Yeah, so this actually hasn't been getting very much cover in mainstream news as we've been so very riveted on the U.S. election campaigns and what's been happening with the DNC and the RNC conventions these past 2 weeks. But I've been noticing that in the media, the attention that has been paid has been primarily as to who's been affected on our soil, you know, because of the whole Katrina debacle. There's been some focus on how New Orleans is doing now and things like that. But, you know, our focus in terms of the mainstream media really hasn't strayed far from home. But there's Cuba and Haiti, and there's a lot of other places that have been hurting very, very much due to this. You know, over the past month, it's been typically Faye and Gustav and Hanna. Those are the three storms in less than 21 days that have been basically devastating the Caribbean region. And at this point, Haiti is very much in a flooded state, and there are estimated to be 600,000 people now at risk for hunger and disease in the aftermath of those effects of these three storms that just piled on top of each other. And as Ike is approaching the region, the situation is likely to grow a lot worse. At least this is what the UN officials are citing to the BBC and other media sources. Haiti's president is calling this an utter catastrophe, this much rain in such a little period of time. And you know, I've really been wanting to find out, you know, well, what kind of relief is being provided? Because when you have, say, a large country and you have a region like, you know, Louisiana or something like that, that is devastated, you have all of these other people from other states and other resources that can come in and try to support the local community if they need it. However, when you have a small country and a big disaster, you know, everybody there is affected and may be in need and not able to offer assistance. So it's really important at times like these for international community members to step up. And I haven't been hearing a lot about that. What I have heard is that at least the UN has provided 33 tons of relief supplies that have been shipped into Haiti. But given what is going to be coming, that's really not likely to be enough. Right now, the waters have not subsided, and there's going to be, unfortunately, some long-term hunger issues that the supplies that have reached their shores aren't going to be able to address. The valley that grows 80% of Haiti's rice has been submerged, and the harvest was ruined before it was actually able to be gathered. So, you know, we're not talking about all of the people. I think it's about 200,000 people that have been 3 days or so without food in Haiti now. We're talking about the whole year's supply of grain gone. So that's an issue. And then also there are plenty of landslides and running low on potable drinking water and other things that are of an immediate concern. But there's going to be some long-range effects as well. In terms of international fundraising efforts, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent societies have launched an appeal to to the international community to try to raise $3.4 million in aid, because what has arrived is not sufficient to meet the need that they're seeing on the ground and what's to come. And the doctors with Doctors Without Borders that are in Haiti right now are reporting that the soil is completely impregnated with water, that the rivers cannot absorb anymore, and that given this and the uncertainty of the path of Ike, things could be getting worse. So basically, it's my suggestion, my belief that if people want to help as they are in need of help, you know, pick the, you know, international aid organization of your choice and who are doing work in Haiti right now, or Cuba, or any of the other surrounding areas, and give what you can. And also, you know, there's always the grassroots way, you know, organize in your community, organize funds, and find a conduit to get what is needed to those in need in that region.
All right. Well, moving on from somewhat natural disasters to man-made disasters, this week in Afghanistan, the carnage continues.
That's right. The U.S.-led international security forces have continued their regime of killing more civilians, typically women and children, compared to the Taliban fighters that supposedly they're trying to target. So on actually August 22nd, was the worst event, single event, of Afghani civilian deaths in the past 7 years, where the estimate ranges between 90-95 people being killed when 15 homes were destroyed in air raid bombing attacks, two-thirds of which were kids, and then there were about under the age of 15, I should say, and then 19 to 20 were women. And this all occurred in the Herat province of Afghanistan. What is of particular interest to me is how the Pentagon has been denying responsibility for this massacre, primarily led by U.S. troops. There's extreme and incredible damage control that's going on, including making the death toll much smaller. They're saying that 30 people were killed. 25 were Taliban fighters and only 5 civilians. And, yeah, those numbers might look a lot better, but this disavowal completely contradicts the UN and international media accounts. So, you know, it's really a no-brainer who to believe about this. So basically, I feel like these attacks and this massacre is basically highlighting how our bombing campaigns aren't working, and we're certainly not winning the hearts and minds of the civilians that are left as we kill their communities and families with these crude methods that we're using that simply aren't working.
All right. That leaves us a minute left for events.
Yes, the Harvest Fair. Seattle Tales Harvest Fair, to celebrate their 30th anniversary, will start today, on now until 5 in the afternoon at Meridian Park in Wallingford. And Thursday night at 7 p.m., an anniversary meeting for Eat the State. This is our 12th anniversary, and we'll have a special session of folding the paper and taping the paper and putting stamps on the paper. So please join us. You can find us at the University Baptist Church at 47th and 12th Northeast in the University District, up on the third floor. We are in the midst of our fundraising drive. Please send money. Our printer is scowling at us, and fundraising has been going a little slowly the last few weeks.
Yeah, we're actually being threatened with pipes. Our kneecaps are in fear for their lives. So please help us.
All right. Talking with Jeff Stevens, Peggy Hotz, and Vanessa Papoy, all with Eat the State, filling in for Jav and Maria this week. And where do people find Eat the State?
Bookstores, coffee shops, King County libraries, and other places where you find free publications, or on the web at eatthestate.org. And you can reach us by phone at 206-719-6947.